te vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Evam kripa naya buddhya. Chusantamatadaranam Grahitum kritadirenam Bayanamabhya padyata Evam kripanaya buddhya Chusantamatadaranam Grahitum kritadirenam Vaya nama vyapadyata Evam kripanaya buddhya Chusantum antadaranam Grahitum kritadirenam Vaya nama vyapadyata Evam thus Kripanaya by miserly Buddha intelligence Susantam lamenting Atatarhanam on which he should not have lamented Grahitum in order to arrest Kritadi the determined king of the Avanas Enam him Bayanama, whose name was fear. Abhyapadyata came there immediately. Translation. Although King Paranjan should not have lamented over the fate of his wife and children, he nonetheless did so due to his miserly intelligence. In the meantime, Yavanaraj, whose name was fear itself, immediately drew near to arrest him. Purport. Foolish people do not know that every individual is responsible for his own actions and reactions in life. As long as the living entity in the form of a child or boy is innocent, it is the duty of the father and mother to lead him into a proper understanding of the values of life. When a child is grown, it should be left up to him to execute the duties of life properly. The parent, after his death, cannot help his child. A father may leave some estate for his children's immediate help, but he should not be overly absorbed in thoughts of how his family will survive after his death. This is the disease of the conditioned soul. Not only does he commit sinful activities for his own sense gratification, but he accumulates great wealth to leave behind so that his children may also gorgeously arrange for sense gratification. In any case, everyone is afraid of death, and therefore death is called bhaya or fear. Although King Puranjan was engaged in thinking of his wife and children, death did not wait for him. Death does not wait for any man. It will immediately carry out its duty. Since death must take away the living entity without hesitation, it is the ultimate God realization of the atheists who spoil their lives thinking of country, society, and relatives to the neglect of God consciousness. In this verse, the word Atat Aranam is very significant, for it means that one should not be overly engaged in welfare activities for one's family members, countrymen, society, and community. None of these will help a person to advance spiritually. Unfortunately, in present-day society, so-called educated men have no idea what spiritual progress is. Although they have the opportunity in the human form of life to make spiritual progress, they remain misers. They use their lives improperly and simply waste them thinking about the material welfare of their relatives, countrymen, society, and so on. One's actual duty is to learn how to conquer death. Lord Krishna states, the process of conquering death in Bhagavad Gita 4.9, Janma karma samedivyam evam yuvati tattvataha tvaktadiham punarjanma naitimam iti surjuna. One who knows the transcendental nature of my appearance and activities does not, upon leaving the body, take his birth again in this material world, but attains my eternal abode, O Arjuna. After giving up this body, one who is fully Krishna conscious does not accept in another material body, but returns home back to Godhead. Everyone should try to attain his perfection. Unfortunately, instead of doing so, people are absorbed in thought of society, friendship, love, and relatives. This Krishna consciousness movement, however, is educating people throughout the world and informing them how to conquer death. Harim bina nasritim taranti. One cannot conquer death without taking shelter of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Om Ajnana Timirandasya Gyanandana Salakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Si Guruve Namaha Shri Chaitanya Mano Bhistam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swapadantikam Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Yutapada Kamalam Sri Gurun Vaisnavamscha Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatam Vidam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Parijana Saitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Sri Visakam Vitamscha He Krishna Karuna Sinha Dina Bandho Jagatpate Gopesa Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namastute Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneswari Vishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vancha kalpa tarubhyacha sakripa sindhubhya evacha patitanam pavanebhyo vaisnavebhyo namo namah Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Sri Vasadi Gaura Bhaktavinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare So translation once again. Although King Puranjan should not have lamented over the fate of his wife and children, he nonetheless did so due to his miserly intelligence. In the meantime, Javanaraj, whose name was fear itself, immediately drew near to arrest him. Om Ajnana Timirandasya. I did it. I go again. Why not? So, Srila Prabhupada is giving a balanced purport. In his purport, he points out that as long as the children are innocent and ignorant, that at that point they need to be protected and guided, but once they have reached maturity, then they should take care of their own survival in this world, in principle. That is, of course, there may be still some additional help given from the parents, but not that parents are meant to endlessly worry on how their relatives will survive after their departure from this world. Survival is a natural instinct, and somehow or other, every living being manages to survive because we are forced to. We're simply forced by the three modes of material nature to act. We cannot escape hunger, thirst, lamentation, infirmity, old age, and death are described like six whips, the six whips of material existence. That means the six forces that drive us forward in life. Just as an animal is prodded by a whip and is moving, in the same way, the living being is moving by hunger, thirst, lamentation, old age, infirmity, and death. That is the nature of being in the material world. So there's no question that someone would not be able to take care of himself under normal circumstances. Rather, under normal circumstances, somehow or other, everyone manages to provide his needs and possibly even beyond. As Gandhi said, the world is big enough for every man's need, but not for every man's greed, which we also are witnessing. So, a wise person who is very generous by nature doesn't make all kinds of opulent arrangements for his family members to continue living after his death. So that seems a little contradictory. A person who's generous does not make all kinds of opulent arrangements. But a miserly person does make all kinds of opulent arrangements. Do we have it upside down? Doesn't it, my generous ancestors have left me this opulent palace and all these wonderful arrangements, all glories to the generosity of my grandfather. No, he was a miser. A miserly man who spent his entire life to satisfy his own senses, who simply was preoccupied with himself, with his own comfort in this world. And even it gave him peace of mind to extend that comfort to his entire dynasty. Durevihavaram karma budiyogat tananjaya. It is said that Budo saranam anvicha kripana valahi tava, that one who is simply preoccupied with his own arrangements in this world and gets involved in all kinds of sinful activity to arrange that. Because after all, the material advantage goes beyond morality, beyond the suffering that one may cause. If we in the so-called first world can exploit the other part of the world, well, what can we do? We need to provide. In Plato's Republic, there is an interesting description. Because basically, the book is about the ideal state. And he's describing the ideal state. And one of the things he describes is that in the ideal state, a city should be built 14 kilometers at a distance of 14 kilometers from the coast. said, should not be on the coast. Said, well, why not? What's wrong with the coast? Ideal city, beautiful view over the ocean. Said, no, on the coast, many sailors will come and they will corrupt the population of your town. So your town must be 14 kilometers away from the coast. And then he's describing a lifestyle in that ideal republic where people live very simple. They sit on wooden furniture and so on. So one man comments and says, this is what you call ideal? And Socrates is, of course, speaking. And Socrates says that, yes, this is ideal. Then what would you like? Would you maybe like some silken cushions? Would you maybe like some varieties of wine and different preparations? Well, the man said, now you're talking. Now you're talking. Now it's getting closer to an ideal. Then, Socrates said, then we need an army. Then we need an army. Because then we need more land. Then we need to invade upon the property of others to exploit them. So that was an interesting beginning, which kind of indicates a little bit what's going on. That as soon as one tries to expand his material facilities in this world, he'll have to do it at the expense of the comfort of others. And he'll have to start infringing upon the shares of others. That is the nature of the material world. Therefore, within the material world, one must be satisfied to meet his material needs in a simple way. That is the recommended arrangement in the material world, because that is what is in accordance with the natural arrangement of the Supreme Lord, at least for most people. I witnessed it in the days that I was buying marble for the Mayapur Samadhi in the desert of Rajasthan, in a small town called Makrana. And this place, Makrana, is a traditional place where marble has been mined for many, many hundreds, maybe even 1,000 years. So traditionally, marble would be taken there from the mine, and marble was used for two purposes, for temples and for palaces. Kings and the Lord, they would have marble. Kings would live in palaces, and kings would have great opulences in their palace, and common men would live in cottages. Well, in that place, in Makrana, there is still the palace of the king. And in fact, that's where we stayed, because now half of it is a hotel these days. But the king of Makrana still lives there in his private quarters, and he's our friend. So anyway, we stayed in the royal palace, and that wasn't bad. Well, it was okay, but it wasn't that good either. I mean, many of the neighbors had houses that were bigger than the royal palace, because that is our modern welfare state, where everyone can be king. Everyone can have a chariot in front of the door. And how many horses, how many horsepower does your chariot have? And everyone can have a royal breakfast. Good morning, Your Majesty. What would you like? Would you like some orange juice from fresh pressed oranges imported from Malaga, Spain, or would you rather have a banana shipped in from South America? Would you like some Swedish knäckebröd this morning, or would you like some British Quaker oats? Or rather, would you go for some toast with French cheese? Well, it's a difficult choice in life. I wonder. In this way, royalty has since long become a common affair. Everyone is meant to have a palace. My God, you're not going to live in a cottage, are you? And even if so, then, you know, on the outside, it may have one appearance, but when you look a little further, there used to be a movie made by the Beatles, of all people, called Help. And you see, like, it begins that the Beatles are very famous and they are in Liverpool. And they are in their hometown, Liverpool, and going to the street, you know, where they sort of grew up, or in the neighborhood where they grew up, in a typical street of working class houses, you know, small little houses. And some old ladies in the street are talking, oh, they are so nice. They are so nice. They stayed so simple, you know. I really appreciated that they became so famous and so wealthy, and that they're still living just in a regular, ordinary house like everybody else. And then you see them, and they all walk into the entrance gate to the front door of their house, right? And they all are having their own little house next to each other, and they open the front door and they go inside. And inside, all the walls between the houses are broken out, and it's all been made into one big pad, and it's got like a huge pit, you know, full of cushions, and it's got fountains inside and light effects and electronics, and it's inconceivable the opulence that exists inside those little houses. That's become a standard, you know. God, I hope that you're not living in poverty. Even the Hare Krishna movement caught up with time. Initially, things were indeed simple. We read stories of Malati living in a cardboard box for a private room, which was, you know, quite basic. I mean, basic facility. A big cardboard box. It was big. It was a big box. So, you know, there was plenty of space. We remember sleeping on the floor. In Amsterdam, it used to be like that, just on the floor. I was in Maya because I used to sleep on my coat because it was freezing. No mattress, straight on the wooden floorboards. Right? And if one thing I hate, it's cold from the floor. So, sense gratification, they said, but I didn't stop it. Survival of the fittest. And then, but within a few years, bunk beds made their entry, and everyone had a nice, neat drawer, etc. And there was progress. Yes. Well, fortunately, the Hare Krishna movement has also become a little more human. What a relief. Yes. And here we are. Here we are, a modern spiritual movement, well adapted to the Western world where we reside, and what is left from our tradition?
Tradition? Do we have one?
Yes, we do. What's it all about?
Nobody knows.
Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur is known as the Acharya who built a bridge from tradition to modernity. It is very interesting because he himself started out in a simple lifestyle, and as a sadhu was amazingly detached and amazingly transcendental. He received from his father, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, a japa mala on which his father had for a period of 3 years followed the same vow of Haridas Thakur. And for a period of 3 years, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur had chanted 300,000 names a day, which over 3 years can accumulate to 1 billion names. And he gave that mala to his son with the same instruction to chant also that quota. And Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur sat in his hut chanting, and we all know during the raining season in Mayapur. I don't know if you know the rainy season in Mayapur, but it's impressive. Sometimes it rains horizontal in Mayapur. You thought rain comes down? Not always. Sometimes there is so much wind that it rains horizontal. So even the biggest umbrella will not have great effect. Other times it really rains buckets. Right? And within no time in Bengal, the rain can flood the grounds. So I sat in an ambassador in Calcutta and it started to really pour down. And within minutes, the streets were getting wet, waterlogged, they say in Calcutta. And then the streets got not only waterlogged, the streets got flooded. And next moment, the water was in the car. And then, before we knew it, we were sitting up to our knees in the water. And it was just about, and the seat of the car was just about to go underwater when we thought, maybe we should get out of this car right now. So, the rain in Bengal is impressive. And Srila Bhaktisiddhanta was not impressed. Not impressed at all. He would just stay inside, keep on chanting his rounds, and just, as the roof was leaking, put up his umbrella. Quite determined, one might say. Quite determined. Very serious about spiritual life. So looking at that kind of a tradition, coming to over the bridge to modern times and then living in modern times with all the complexities and so on. This verse about King Puranjan not leaving all kinds of arrangements for his children seems to be something a little alien. It seems that in this world, to survive, you need a lot. You have to have a lot, even by law. For example, in many cities of the world, even if you don't have television, you still have to pay for the cable connection. We had a huge fight in Amsterdam so many years back when I was staying in a temple there, about this point, that we had to pay for the cable connection. He said, we don't watch TV. Yeah? So we're not going to pay for what we don't watch. No, you have to. You have the right to watch TV. And you have to pay. Therefore, you have to pay. It's ridiculous. We didn't want that right. Yeah? He said, no. You're very, very fortunate that you have this right. You can also, you are free to watch TV. Am I also free not to watch TV? Well, that's ridiculous. You're not appreciating the freedom, the freedom that we have in modern society. Well, so the point or the crux of the presentation in this verse is that we cannot bother, we cannot spend so much time for material arrangements, which somehow or other will come on their own accord. We'll manage to adjust. Living beings have a tremendous capacity to adjust. Somehow or other, they manage when they have to. Therefore, the essence is of a different nature. We remember in the Ramayana the description of the Emperor Dasarath, who was receiving the sage Vishwamrita Muni. And upon receiving the sage of the sage, he inquired from him, and he asked him, "How are you proceeding in the conquest of birth and death?" Instead of sort of saying, "Hey, long time no see, how are you?" Okay? Which is the modern approach. No. How are you proceeding in the conquest of birth and death? And this question remains for all of us as a question that we can from time to time ask each other and ask ourselves. How are we proceeding in this regard? Have we made progress? Are we sort of ready now? Are we ready to deal with death? Well, no, not really. Not yet, please. Rather not. That's generally our mood. The urgency, the lack of time is becoming apparent. That life is very short. And that one can really not spend too much time making too many material arrangements. Because after all, the material world is a temporary domain where we are in transit. And wherever we are in transit, how much time are we going to spend to get serious about staying there? Just like me, I basically live from a suitcase, and this suitcase goes with me around the world, and it's sort of... But the fact of the matter is that most of the time, or practically 99% of the time, I never unpack that suitcase. Everything stays in that suitcase, and I only take out a few things. And sometimes I think, why don't I just take those few things with me and forget the whole suitcase? Right? Since I never unpack practically 99% of my suitcase anyway, why do I have it? Right? It's that one time that, you know, you do need it. And it's convenient. But in that way, there are people who have a huge house and who are collectors, just in case. You never know. And just store that. It might come in handy. Right? Oh, yes. And it's been stored there. And I know we have one of those things somewhere. Somewhere. No, I know we do. Right? And it takes hours and hours to find it. But, I found it. Right? Maybe it's like one of those British tropical helmets against hot burning sun, which we never have, of course, in the Benelux. But then again, for that one occasion in a lifetime when there is an unbearable heat stroke, hey, I've got one of these tropical helmets somewhere. I've seen it 7 years ago, and I'm quite sure it's up there somewhere. And after 7 hours, you have found it, and it will give you 7 minutes of comfort before a big cloud ends the tropical sun shining in the Benelux. Oh, well. So, in this way, we are preoccupying ourselves with so many unnecessary things. And if we could just get ourselves to make nice arrangements, but relatively simple arrangements, then we could maybe develop some good habits. Good habits to invest in spiritual activity. It's difficult because a human being, or all living beings by nature, are inclined towards habits. One may recall that particular story where Srila Prabhupada was pointing at a pile of bird droppings that was under a particular tree. And Prabhupada said, What does this mean?
And the devotees were thinking, my God, you know, should we have some sort, is this a mystical thing? You know, should we try to read some sort of meaning in the bird stool? We're going to do some bird stool reading here. What does it mean? And no one could figure it out. And Prabhupada said, it means that bird is coming here every day and is passing stool every day in the same place. So it means that these creatures, even birds, are habit forming and also attached. So habits are a second nature. Every day, the same routine. Oh, yes. It's just the easiest, right? It's the you've got it worked out. Right? Yes, a whole system. Everyone has his system. And in this way, we all get locked into habits. And then we get so conditioned by these habits that it's very difficult to act in another way. After 27 years of cornflakes for brekkie, it's practically impossible to do one day without. Oh no. I mean, and in going 3 weeks to India, I mean, that means like four boxes. Yeah. I mean, they shrink, you know. They shrink a lot when they go in the milk, right? Yeah, and you want them crunchy and everything in four boxes, right? That's an extra backpack, huh? Somehow or other, right? We'll smuggle that extra backpack in. And everyone in the world is traveling like that. I used to have an Italian secretary in Vrindavan. At one point, he got jaundice, right? And then he had the miracle cure for jaundice. You know what it was? Guess what? Olive oil. It is the miracle cure for jaundice. Yes, and he was preaching to me the glories of olive oil, and I was saying, yeah, of course, olive oil is the miracle cure for jaundice, for Italians. You know, obviously, you know, it wasn't. He said, no, but it's in a book. I said, yeah, an Italian book, you know. I didn't have faith, you know. So in this way, all of us are conditioned by our habits, and we just kind of, when we get so busy with material arrangements, we get out of the habit of preoccupying ourselves with simple things like chanting and like reading. For example, the day that the first devotees started to communicate through computers, we thought they were completely insane. We thought that, like, you know, what a weird, outlandish hobby, you know, to just play around and get so much into computers that you start to communicate with people. I mean, little did we know that it would completely take over our society and that it completely would take over every aspect of your life. Do you also have it sometimes that you wake up in the middle of the night at 1:33 a.m. according to your phone, and that you also feel this strong drive to download? download now. And then once you have downloaded, right, then you can relax and sleep again. I've heard of people who get up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom. But that is not the biggest problem these days. These days, the problem is to download.
And doctors are inquiring from their patients, how many downloads are you having in the night? So we could possibly see that we too are a little bit affected by some habits that are taking us away from chanting. I recall the days when there were no computers. Jeez. Yeah, those days, you know, you sometimes even thought of, well, maybe let's just chant some extra rounds. And you would regularly see devotees pacing up and down, chanting extra rounds. Believe it or not, yes, it would happen. These days, who has time for these things? So much to do. Really, so busy. So many types of communication. And then, in between all that, right? Sadhana, 16 rounds is sort of, it's quite a struggle, quite an endeavor. But fortunately, by the skin of our teeth, we're still hanging in there. The King Puranjan story is not a story about materialistic people. The King Puranjan story is not even a story just relevant for householders. The King Puranjan story is actually relevant even for the renunciants. Even for the renunciants who are so caught up in complexities, and therefore everyone can see that maybe there still lives a little Puranjan in us. And we thought that there was the super soul in our heart. And he is. But have we ever thought of the little Puranjan living there, deep down in our heart? Oh. With these kind of contemplations, I want to kind of mentally prepare you for the next part of this morning's class, which is the question and answers. So this is the moment where you can scratch the head or grab the chin or slowly start to crank up the wheels and come with a deep philosophical question or comment. Most welcome. Thank you very much. Do I have a computer? I have two computers. Yeah? So? Yeah? Yeah. Well, I would rather not, but the looks are deceiving, you know, they say. But I would rather not have one, but then again, another part of me would rather have one. And ultimately, I decided to have one. And when I had one, I thought I may as well have a good one. Right? Although it doesn't really show that much on the outside. It is, of course, Apple, but beyond that, you know, you can't see what's inside. But it's packed up with lots of power. And in this way, it's less of an austerity. It's a little less of an austerity. The problem with a computer is that it's not a direct extension of the mind. If only I could think, and there, whoop, it was already on the screen. If only I wouldn't have to type. If only I wouldn't have to fight with a damn thing that doesn't want to do what I wanted to do. Right? If only, right? If only all that wasn't part of it, then maybe it wouldn't be so bad. But anyhow, why do I have one then? Well, possibly for two reasons. One is the one I tell myself, and the other one is the one I don't tell myself. The reason I tell myself is that I use fire to fight fire. I use computers to get rid of computers. I drive in cars to rid the world of cars altogether. And I fly in planes to eliminate all this artificial travel from the world. And this is my sacrifice. This is the part I like to tell myself. The part I don't like to tell myself is that I like computers. Is that I am addicted to computers. That I can't stop playing with computers because it gives me power. Power, and I thrive on it. And, you know, I can spend hours with my computer and it responds to me in so many ways. And thank God, for this I don't have to communicate with people. Oh God, with people. Instead of having relationships with people, thank God, now I can love my computer. And my life has improved tremendously, tremendously. In the past, I would spend too much of my time trying to relate to people. Oh boy. But they, you know, the programs that are part of these people, oh God, they're not at all user-friendly. No, I'm so happy now that I have a relationship with a computer. But that's the part I never tell myself. Anybody else? No. Any questions? No. It's already finished. Gosh. No comments. No realizations. Nothing. I can of course ask a question to myself and then just answer it. Yeah. Anyway, a hand has emerged, just as I said, anyway. I was going to say something. Okay, I swallow my words. Yes. Okay, I forgot now. Undo care, not just not care, but undo care. And there is do care and undo care. And that's why the purport is extremely balanced, because it speaks about do care. Because the problem with ISKCON is that we Westerners, we tend to go for an idea, you know. It's a very Western thing to do, to go for an idea. So you have a particular, we shouldn't spend time with caring for, what was it, you said it, community and all that, right? And then we immediately turn it on zero, right? Then we turn it on zero. Whereas, you know, in India, they are different, you know, it is, people are more natural. India is a very natural society. And the West is a very artificial society where you go for an idea, a role, a standard. But India, chalega, you know. Even in the middle of the shop, the man lifts one side and lets out a certain noise and looks at you as, what to do? It's life. Whereas in the West, you go like, we talk about it for 3 days. A very natural society in all respects, in human relationships and so on. So we sometimes forget that these These books are coming from a tradition which is much more natural than ours. And therefore, when we read it, we kind of fill it in like Gestapos, right? And when there is a little bit of renunciation emphasized in the scriptures, we practice renunciation with boots, right? And just make it so hard and so rigid and so cold and so impersonal, and then we get 20-30 years later, we get the social complaint, and we have books about it. Recently, someone gave me a little black book, a little black book called My Karma, My Fault, with blood red letters 3 times on the cover. Oh, God, the story, a story of child abuse in all the gory details. Okay. What to do? The social complaint. And the ladies chanting in the cold corridors for so many years. That I guess many of them became advanced through that. They got the mercy. But it was rough mercy, I guess. Now, some things are more balanced. I said some. And of course, as always, the pendulum swings when it comes to balance. So let's see what comes now. Maybe the pendulum will swing the other way. That's also there, talking about balance. So balance is difficult. But Prabhupada was most balanced. Very concerned for genuine human need, and at the same time, very detached, soft as a rose, and hard as a thunderbolt. So this purport is soft as a rose, and hard as a thunderbolt. And I desire that my lecture also will be, or has been, soft as a rose, and hard as a thunderbolt. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.